This is a Cyber Union talk show for Monday, August 8th, 2011. Solidarity for starters.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
Hello and welcome to the Cyber Unions podcast. I'm Walton in Glasgow, Scotland.
And I'm Stephen in Boston, Massachusetts, in the States.
Stephen, have you had a good week? What have you been up to this week?
A good amount, actually. Been keeping myself busy. Sorry, I was talking away from the microphone there. I actually went down to the FSF, the Free Software Foundation, again. I've been spending some time down there, which has been good. They're a really good bunch of people, and just kind of helping out and volunteering in different ways. But I did find out something really cool, which I didn't know until this week, which is that the Free Software Foundation staff are unionized. And
oh, fantastic. Yeah. That's really good.
And not only are they unionized, they're unionized under the UAW. And for our non-American listeners, that's the United Auto Workers of America. Actually, it's actually the United Auto Aeronautical. It's like a huge long list of A words.
All right. So are they making cars down at the FSF now?
No. They do have a lot of GNU stuffed animals, GNU stickers, or new stickers, I guess you could say. But they are not making any automobiles. but it is actually the same union that I was a part of when I was a graduate student at UMass Amherst. So I'm surprised I actually didn't know about their drive, which was in 2003 is when they gained recognition. And it's pretty cool. I was really psyched to hear that. And it's going to lead to a lot more information down the road. I'm going to be having further discussions with a number of people at the FSF, both about campaigns and in general about the history of their union drive, because I'm very curious as a labor historian nut to know what happened.
Well, that's really fascinating. I mean, for me, that's kind of what the show is about, is bringing the open source community and trade unions together. And there we have a living example of it just down the road from you.
Yeah. So what have you been up to?
So we can go home and cancel the show now because it's all sorted, right?
Yeah. All right. Let's let's end it now. The show is over. We only got to 12 and then we just ran out of steam.
And then, yeah. I had an interesting week. I did some training on social media for some finance sector union reps. They work in a big insurance company, and went to their national reps conference and did training sessions on technology, new media, and organizing. So there's some stuff that comes out of that I thought maybe we could talk about in the show.
Oh, that's great.
Other thing I thought might be worth talking about is, I don't know if you've checked the website recently, but there's a whole interesting comments string that came about after our collective bargaining discussion the previous show. So I thought maybe it would be worth talking a bit more about collective bargaining and what international solidarity means. And, you know, there's been some stuff happening in the news as well, which feeds into that discussion. So
I think that seems like a great topic.
Yeah, it might be a bit political and ranty, but you know, maybe if we do some sort of
there's no room for politics in the labor movement. I don't know what you're talking about. We are supposed to just do our job, get paid, get our contract, and that is it. Nothing more. It's only about wages. It's only about wages and benefits, the bread and butter. It's nothing about conditions. It's nothing about the economy. No, all right, of course. All right. We have to finish the show now. No, I think there's a lot to go there. And as an American, I'll say, shocked that the insurance and the financial sector has unions, because we don't have that. And I think we are the financial center of the world, unfortunately. Uh-huh. And I really wish they were organized, because, man, I'd love to talk to some of them.
Well, maybe I'll contextualize a bit and say that the finance sector in the UK is organized. The union that I work for is a big general union, and the finance sector is actually its biggest sector. I'm pulling this figure out of the air, but I think there's 200,000 members, finance sector members in our union. Yeah, all the really big banks have union agreements.
Our big banks have anti-union agreements, which is doing whatever they can to prevent a union from coming in.
Yeah, I mean it's not perfect. Union density in the finance sector is a lot lower than in public sector, and especially manufacturing. In our manufacturing sector, we've got much higher density. And you know, I think there are cultural problems in the finance sector, which mean people are more likely to identify with the company. You know, the finance sector engages in all this soft HR practice, which I'm sure you're familiar with. You know, the kind of teamwork, and we're all in it together, and that kind of stuff.
Otherwise known as complete bullshit. Yes,
that's the one. So you don't really see that so much in the manufacturing sector, where it's just pure out and out animosity between the employer and the workers to some extent. And the finance sector, because there's this kind of pretense of partnership, it's a bit harder to organize unions. But nonetheless, we've got some very, very good union reps in the finance sector, some really, really fantastic people that I enjoy working with. And I got to speak at their conference. It was a particular insurance company that I went to. And I did a workshop I did the same workshop three times for different groups of reps, and we spoke about essentially how they could use technology to organize in their own workplace. And it is a good workplace for using technology, because it's a white collar workplace, and mm-hmm. People work on computers, but also a lot of them have smartphones as well. So even if certain sites are blocked at work, people can access them through their smartphones. So we spoke about the usual suspects, Twitter and Facebook. Also some of the problems with Facebook, and we also spoke about Diaspora and Google Plus. And I was really impressed with him, because out of the three groups, when I spoke about Google Plus, two of them asked really, really good searching questions about the privacy, which I was impressed with. But anyway, I was thinking of it would be handy at this point maybe to something of a review of Google Plus. I mean, it's only been around for a month or so, we've used it a bit, so we're by no means experts, but it has two features which I think are useful for trade unionists, and one concern, or a couple of concerns. So and this is kind of what I was saying to the reps that I was working with. Are you happy for me to just kind of shoot what I think?
Go right ahead. I'll jump in when I feel necessary.
Cool. So cool thing number one about Google Plus that makes it better than Facebook is the fact that it has this thing called circles, which is the same as Diaspora's aspects. And what happens with circles is that you can divide the people in your life into various groups. So you can have a group called work, and a group called friends, and a group called family, and a group called random nutters off the internet, and any group you like.
Is that the one I'm in?
As many groups as you like. That's the one, yeah. What's quite good about that is it means you can use Google Plus for networking without having the various aspects of your life bleed into each other. So in other words, you can talk work to your work people, you can talk family stuff to your family stuff without your grandmother seeing drunken pictures of you after a night on the tiles. and the other thing about it that's quite cool is it avoids this whole awkward thing about, you've never been on Facebook, but there's this thing on Facebook where you meet someone, you have a pint, you get along okay, you find them on Facebook and you think, do I send them a friend request or not? Do I know them well enough? Eventually you send them the request. They get the request and they go, all right, him, I don't know. Do I know him well enough? Do I want him to see all those holiday pictures? Do I accept? Do I not? So Google Plus doesn't have that at all. It's like Twitter, it has, and Identica. It just has this kind of opt-in where you can follow people. And then it's up to them whether they want to follow you or not, put you in the random nutter circle, ignore you, whatever. And if you're following someone, you only get to see their public posts. So it's much better on privacy. Like Google has spent a bit of time making it easy for you to choose what it is that you want to share, and kind of streaming your content in those kinds of ways. So it's worthwhile from that perspective, and it's pretty easy to use. So I thought that was good.
Yeah, it's nice.
The other thing, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I find some of the circles helpful. I mean, I've used it a little bit. I'm still deep downside with StatusNet, so I still dent on there. But I do like the flexibility of not having any limit on the amount of characters that you can post in there. So, like, where Twitter has mm-hmm. that limitation. Facebook, the last time I used Facebook, I did use it once. It was, I think, 2005. And I just one, I didn't want to reconnect with all my high school friends, so that's one of the first reasons why I cut off of it. But the real reason was their privacy concerns were a big issue for me. And the poking thing was really annoying after a while. But anyhow, Google Plus, I think, I feel they've done a better job of integrating different features that are both in Firefox, or not Firefox, Hello, and I want to say Friend Face, which is from the IT crowd.
Yeah.
They've
Freak done a good Book job. Friend Face, we all know what you mean.
Yeah, exactly. They did a good job of integrating some stuff from there, and also from Twitter, and then some of the elements of XMPP, where you can keep the communication as a real time, I guess you could say. But there's some cool features. Still things I'm concerned about, though. It's Google, after all.
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, I feel like I'm a bit over social networking because I had the whole Facebook experience, and everyone from not just my high school but my primary school contacted me. And I find Google Plus is a bit better for following people who are interesting, not people I know. So like Twitter in that way, that you find someone who's a journalist or who is whatever, and they do interesting things and they post interesting stuff. And it's a good way of following them and getting a bit more content than the 140 character limits on Identica and Twitter. The other feature, which I think is cool and which I think unions could use, is this thing called Hangouts. Now, Hangouts is Google Plus voice over internet protocol. Basically, it's video chat.
Yep.
It works like Skype. I think it's a lot easier to use than Skype, and it has the added benefit of doing group video chat. You can have up to 20 people at once in a video chat, and you'll see a whole bunch of little screens on your screen with all the faces of your friends that you're speaking to, and the person who speaks, their screen is enlarged, and you see them bigger than everyone else, and you can all talk to each other. And the reason I thought that would be useful is that you can potentially have an online union meeting. You know, you can get a group of union people together and very, very easily, low barriers to access, click a couple of the links and get an online union meeting going. And it's worth saying that we, Stephen and I, have actually used Hangouts a bit to record the show, kind of as a test. So any thoughts on Hangouts and how you found them?
It was interesting. It does seem that the page that it loads has a lot of things going on. And I think we immediately felt a bit of a drag on the bandwidth, which I could only imagine having a large group meeting, what that would be like with the bandwidth concerns if people are not connecting with high-speed internet or whatever. But I guess the other thing is, my concern, I guess, would be that I haven't seen yet, and is, you know, if we're going to have union meetings online, what's the possibility that Google might be recording it, or could the boss get access to
that? Well, see, that is a really good question, and I did some, and in fact, this is why I was so impressed with those union reps, because the two groups asked that. They said, say we have this union meeting, can it be recorded? The answer is yes. So I've done a bit of research. The good thing about Google Hangouts is that it does use an open source protocol. It does use XMPP, Jabber, and the Jingle, which is the video protocol add onto it, does use an open standard, and Google doesn't by default record things. The chats are all off record. The video chats and voice chats are all off record. However, it is possible to record them. If law enforcement asks them to record a conversation, they are probably compelled to do so. So
I think we want a federated version of this somehow that we can put onto the Pirate Bay servers in, what is it, Sweden? So nothing will get turned over to the authorities or in our house where we can easily dispose of it,
One thing that's worth saying is that this information about the fact that the calls can be recorded comes from Google themselves. So I'm at least pleased that they're upfront about the fact that they can record the conversations and they might do them in some situations. So I feel like with Google, you essentially do a deal with them. You know, they tell you what the deal is, and the deal is they're going to take a whole bunch of information about you and use it. But at least you know what that is. You know, with Facebook, I felt the relationship was a lot more dishonest. So I would say that if you have a need for a social network and you're absolutely sick of Freakbook, then it might be worth jumping ship and trying out Google Plus, because it actually works better. It's got better functionality than Facebook. It doesn't have Farmville, you know, a whole lot of the rubbish which is on Facebook's not on Google Plus. It's pretty good. It's worth a try. So give it a shot, but don't say we didn't warn you about the privacy.
Yes. I'm sure at some point we'll be getting advertisements before, just as we're saying the words, and some advertisement will pop up for me. And Anyhow, but yeah, there's always that concern. Go on.
And then, yeah, just the other thing was talking about finance sector workers and the fact that our union organizes so many different banks. And since the financial crisis, we've had real problems with banks laying off workers, because same as in the US, our banks were bailed out and they should now technically belong to the taxpayer, but they're still, they're still trying to get out of the crisis by shedding workers. But interestingly, even the banks that aren't in crisis are shedding workers, because we just heard the news that HSBC, the big international bank, has made £7 billion worth of profit.
Holy
and
hell.
It's celebrating by shedding 30,000 jobs.
So they want more.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and when I see stuff like that, I just realize that the system is fundamentally broken. It's like the social contract is broken. Like after World War II, there was a deal done between workers and bosses, between capital and labor, which basically said that if we accept the right of capital to run the economy, then capital will guarantee a fairly decent standard of life for working people. And particularly one which gradually improves. So your life might not be fantastic, but your children's lives will be slightly better, and your grandchildren will be slightly better. And you get the sense that humanity is slowly evolving into a better place. And it just seems to me now that that social contract has been torn up fundamentally all over the world. It's certainly in the UK, you know, when you see news like that about HSBC, in Greece, where it's just, you know, things are completely broken, where you've got waiters occupying the restaurants that they used to work in because they're not being paid for months. The system is completely broke. I don't know if you feel the same way about what's happening in the US. I mean, I don't hear good things about...
Everything's fine over here. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. All right.
Again, I mean, no. Yeah, we had a similar thing. In post-World War II, there was the I think it was the Capital Labor Accord. I can't even speak today. Sorry for that. And that was basically it. There was this triangle of power. And this was when labor unions were very powerful in the States. And by very powerful, I mean... We eventually got to the highest percentage of the workforce representation, which was 35%, and that happened like if that was in the late 50s, I think it was, or early 60s, when we were at the height of our total amount of density in the labor movement. And labor was feared, but it was also because of the economic structure. Like the power of determining the economy was at the top. It was the government, the businesses, and the labor leaders. And the government came in our country, in the States, in a position of moderating. They decided to moderate. They saw that there was this division, that there was this conflict between business and labor. And they thought that the appropriate thing to do was to create a means to bring them into a court that wasn't a judicial court to hammer out their differences. And that's what they created the National Labor Relations Board to do that. And they established these boards across the country. And the idea was that the government would not choose either side. They would choose the just side and call on the side of justice. And that there is a time period historically in the U.S. labor history that existed where there was a true balance between the three. But it didn't last that long. It started to deteriorate in the 60s, and then when the 70s happened, it just got basically thrown underneath the rug. And the government ended up, the government getting taken over by businesses ends up being on the side of business. So it's like a 2-to-1 odd in a decision. It's just like, well, it's like packing the court. You're not going to be able to win. And labor in the U.S., labor unions started losing these battles tremendously, ones that they had won thoroughly. And it was the biggest slap in the face that labor unions ever got was with the wonders of Ronald Reagan, when he fired the air traffic controllers in the 1980s.
I've heard of that one, yeah.
And he had gotten the endorsement of that union for his presidential election under the knowledge that he was going to side with them. The story that's not told, and this is the interesting part, is Jimmy Carter's administration, the previous administration, was the one who wrote the how to handle if the air control workers go on strike. and how to bring in the military to do it. So nobody really knows that the original plan was actually designed under Jimmy Carter's administration and then implemented under Reagan, which also shows in our country that our politics within the two parties are very similar.
You know, fortunately, you've got Obama now, so everything's fine, right?
Oh, God. unfortunately, no. I mean, I could say things seem better, like on the surface, but there's not that much that has changed since the Obama administration's come in. One, there's still the political battle. Appointing the people that go onto the National Labor Relations Board is a decision that's done by the Senate, and the Senate has these stupid rules where you need to not get a majority of the Senate to approve it. You have to get 2/3 of the Senate to approve it. So the Democrats don't have the entire 2/3. So they'd have to get some Republicans, and Republicans are strongly against labor unions in most cases, not all of them, but most of them, enough to the point where they stick in line and they don't appoint the ones that Obama has appointed or asked to appoint. So it gets really cumbersome, and even then, at the end of the day, things haven't drastically changed. I mean, there are still laws on the books that make it really hard. Like, there's a law that was passed under the Bush administration that still is on the books that if 30% of a unionized workforce feels that they don't want a union, they can petition for it, and that starts the process of trying to redetermine whether there should be a union in that workplace. So it's like a new re-election of a union in the workplace, and the union movement right here in the States is not strong. They are struggling, and that solidarity that they need internally isn't necessarily there all the time, and it's a losing battle in a lot of cases.
But I saw something on Twitter today that says Obama isn't a secret Muslim socialist. He's a secret rich white guy.
I think that, I mean, his sad thing is, historically, he was a community organizer with a very radical organization back in the day. And so there was all this hope when he was coming into his election that he was going to revert back to those thoughts and ideas and ideals. And even in his early election, there were things that came up in the election campaign. And there was a former leader of the Weathermen, which was a radical organization that bombed in the States.
And you don't need a weatherman to tell you which way the wind's blowing.
That was their slogan, which was the best part, because they saw where the economy was going, they saw where the political system was going, and they knew what to attack. And they were a radical leftist group that was for all intents and purposes, they identified as the white version of the Black Panthers, and were in solidarity with those movements. But they felt the important part was to be a movement within the community that you're part of, and not to jump into different communities. So he had connections. He worked with a guy who was a head leader of them back in the day, and they started, the right wing just went nuts with that. And they were just like, oh, he's this Marxist socialist, blah, blah, blah. And I understand Marxism. I advocate for it. I'm the one looking. I'm like, no, he's not. And if he was, he'd be gaining my support on so many different levels. But I'm like, he's not. And we can't expect the change to come from the top. We need to expect the change to come from the bottom. And
well, you know, I think that's a really important point, because this whole thing about the social contract being broken means that politics is broken as well. Because all the political parties can do is tinker with a social contract. So you vote for one party or the other, and it changes the framework that things happen in a bit. But the way things have fundamentally broken down means that I think they need to be fundamentally renegotiated. We need a new social contract. And to negotiate that, it's not going to happen in Parliament. It's going to happen where power is. And power is in the workplace, in the streets, and in communities. And you know, the cities, I think we should be trying to deprivatize public spaces and bring them back into the commons, and you know, look at what people are doing around the world to take power back from a political system which has given up all control to big multinational corporations. And you know, that the whole thing, I've been thinking about how do you actually do that. And there was an interesting debate going with someone called Caustic Castle on the website, and it was a response to what we had said in two shows previously about collective bargaining. And he's a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and he was essentially saying that union agreements don't really work, because you're just signing an agreement with a company, and that the IWW model of solidarity unionism works a lot better, where every member is an activist, and everyone takes direct action to support everyone else. And I was contrasting that with the best efforts of the trade union movement to create global solidarity on an international level. So in a way, take the old IWW ideal of one big union for the whole world, but how can you actually do that? And I was looking at the global union federations. Now, I don't know if listeners are familiar with this, but if you're a trade union member, the union you're a member of is probably affiliated to a national trade union center. So it might be AFL-CIO or Change to Win, or it might be the TUC in the UK, FNV in the Netherlands, COSATU or FEDUSA in South Africa. There's a whole bunch of them. Some countries have more than one. In a lot of European countries, there are political and religious differences according to which federation you belong to. But there are also federations at international level. There are these global federations. So there's the IMF, which is the International Metalworkers Federation, UniGlobal, which is the International Union for Service Workers, Education International, International Federation of Journalists, International Transport Workers Federation. There are all these big international unions, and they do something which would be interesting if it really worked very well, and that is they negotiate these things called International Framework Agreements. And what they do is they negotiate with multinational companies, and they sign collective agreements that cover not just workers in one country, but workers everywhere where that country has an operation. And not only that, the agreements cover not just those workers, but workers in the supply chain as well. Now, that is a fantastic idea, because it means that if you sign an agreement with, say, Volkswagen, and Volkswagen is sourcing parts from China or some other place as part of the supply chain, that agreement should cover those workers. And it means that you have a collective agreement that covers workers who are not members of the union, because they can't be members of the union because maybe trade unions are outlawed where they work, or whatever the case might be. And you can potentially raise the standards of working people across the world with these big agreements. The problem comes, how do you enforce it? And I think, you know, we know really that the only way you can properly enforce labor standards is workers need to do it themselves. You know, you can never rely on a government ultimately to do that for you, or, you know, United Nations or some big international organization. And, you know, for me, the way the IFA's international framework agreements are negotiated, they're still a bit too weak to be as powerful as they should be. Have you had any experience of IFAs in the US and of that kind of collective bargaining?
I mean, the concept is known. Its practice is limited. I mean, in fact, there was a news article I just saw today that was by your sister union, the United Steelworkers, that had just signed a master agreement, which is similar to an IFA. A master agreement is covering one industry, but it's for a specific group of states and a company that has plants, and also companies within that same industry that have plants in those same states. And they had actually signed a master agreement. And that's the first time I have seen a master agreement of any sorts, like even in the news. I almost want to say, at least in my conscious lifetime, which is probably about the last 11 years, consciousness in the sense of knowing that we're not in the best system. they used to be something that was more common back in before the 70s, I would say, back when the labor unions were very strong in this country, and when companies didn't want to spend money doing anti-union efforts because they felt that was going to bleed into their profits. And now they see that they could actually spend more now and still make more profits down the road by fighting off unions. And so they're kind of not relevant as much as they used to be because the labor's lost its power in this country. We have gotten down to almost, we're down to single digits in the private sector. We're barely in double digits in the public sector. So our overall percentage is very, very low. So these agreements are hard to come by, and they're not as vital, because the labor unions in the states are trying to reemerge, and they're trying to survive, and they're trying to rebuild. And their concentration on, and not that they don't concentrate on global solidarity, they do. It's just that the international framework agreements, they don't necessarily have all the power to enforce them. So it's a much harder thing to put a lot of effort into. And I am editorializing here a bit, so I don't want to come across as saying that I know all. It's just from my own research and familiarity with the labor movement in the States.
I mean, the one thing that's interesting about the U.S. labor movement is that in some ways things are so bad for you that if you manage to organize in those difficult conditions, you actually have really good lessons for everyone else. And around the world, unions are adopting organizing models which develops in the U.S. under those conditions. Because basically, if it succeeds in the U.S., it's going to succeed anywhere because, you know, your conditions are so much worse than everyone else's.
Yeah, that's a great thing for us. We are number one in anti-union efforts. I mean, it's an industry in of itself. I mean, there's some anti-union companies. In fact, there's like this one big right-wing nutcase that has created unionfacts.com and has put out all this false information. But the thing is, there's so much public information that's available about unions. They just post that information. That same information is not available about corporations. So, like, talk about an unbalanced work field that we're dealing with. Is that they can look at how much assets a union actually has, whereas a company can actually hide assets. You know, but anyhow, yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's great that our strategies that do work are being, I guess, exported, but or shared for that matter. But
I mean,
go on.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I wish there was a way that we could get these IFAs to work really, really solidly, because collective bargaining does work when there's the strength to make sure that agreement is honored. And in the UK, we've seen really good agreements. Our union, Unite, has achieved with some of the supermarkets where they've agreed not just to cover the supermarket workers, but workers in the supply chain for a number of lines, particularly in food production. Now, in the UK, agribusiness and food production is some of the worst paid, most dangerous work, and it's mostly done by migrant workers who are not union members. And the union has been able to negotiate supply chain agreements which cover terms and conditions for workers in those industries who would otherwise be really, really vulnerable. Now, for me, that's fantastic. It's really, really progressive, and that's good stuff. And you know, we really need to be internationalizing that kind of thing so that the strongest workers, the strongest negotiators should be able to negotiate on behalf of the people who are more vulnerable and not able to. And, you know, I think this is a discussion we're going to need to keep coming back to. I don't think we can solve this problem tonight. But, you know, I would suggest that we kind of, you know, keep encouraging people to comment on the show and keep these ideas coming in and let's have a serious discussion about global solidarity and how it looks in practice. What do we actually do?
Yeah. And just to kind of add, just because I feel it's important for people to understand that, you know, the dynamics are the same almost in every country when it comes to specific industries. So migrant workers are also in the States, the likely workers that are working in the fields and working on the farms and pulling the crops and everything like that. And the same thing in our National Labor Relations Act does not actually protect agricultural workers. It specifically does not protect them.
Wow.
And there's only one state that has actually gone above and beyond to actually create a law, and that was California. And that was because there was a huge farmer uprising under Cesar Chavez, creating the United Farm Workers. But there are also other I can't say unions. There's the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which many people would think is a union, but they advocate for the same things. They're basically bargaining, and this is actually interesting. This is definitely something that would be intriguing, is because they're trying to develop a framework for their industry in a lot of ways. The tomatoes that they actually pick in southern Florida, where they are, go to McDonald's, go to Chipotle, go to all these big Burger King, Taco Bell, all these big corporations. And they went instead of going to their farmers, who are their actual bosses, they went to the corporations to get them to change the conditions that they are in. And I mean, these were huge battles. These were a lot of youth battles. There were a lot of college students that did food, like hunger strikes and everything, in front of their corporations to get them to quite literally raise the amount that they're paid, 1 cent per pound of tomatoes that they carry. There's been a lot of success in that, but they won't identify as a union because there are legalities and legal issues that they go that go with that in the United States. So by being an organization that essentially works in very similar ways, they're able to have a little bit more freedom than labor unions actually have in this country, which kind of gets into a little bit of the other discussion that we want to get into here too, with dual unionism and also the IWW and their model. But I mean, I think global solidarity is obviously key. Solidarity as a whole is key. Without solidarity, you don't win. And it's not just a matter of winning. It's taking the part of the pie that you deserve and that you created away from those that exploit it and sell it.
Or the whole bakery, if needs be.
Oh, yeah, I think we all want the whole bakery. We want the whole farm, too, which is also a whole other discussion. But there is a lot of... I think historically, economically, there's this misconception of what solidarity means globally. In the States, post World War II, we became the epicenter of where the economy was or is, or I don't know where it is anymore. It's all over the place. But so unions in the States, unless they're very far left and radical, their concept of global solidarity didn't really make sense to them because they're like, well, we got great benefits, we got great conditions, and I am able to buy a really nice car and buy a home and everything like that, so I don't care. And there was no internal, there was no internal organizing to educate and members educating themselves to understand that this economy is going to grow beyond our borders. This economy is going to eventually change, and that's what happened. And when it did, they didn't know how to handle it, and their way of handling it was buy American. Which, like, that's not global solidarity. That's buy American. And buying American doesn't mean buying union. And I always felt like it's important to buy union made, and it doesn't matter where it's made as long as it's union made. Is my perspective, and that's where global solidarity is. If you see oppression happening in another country in your industry, you stop working till those conditions are changed, because there is that power. And I think it's becoming more prevalent now that people are starting to understand that global economy has been around for a lot longer than they realize. I mean, it's not that new. I mean, Columbus did come to the States, not, you know, because he wanted to find this other country. He came here to eventually exploit it. So it's been around for quite some time. I'm trying to figure where to go with this, Walton.
I think what we should do is maybe have a look at the whole dual card IWW model, but do it in another show, because I think, you know, I'd like to do it justice, because it is a different model of trade unionism, and it's got, you know, it's got maybe quite a lot to tell us. But I'm concerned that we won't be able to do it justice if we try and fit it in today. What do you think?
That's not a bad idea, and I think I feel, and I hope for our listeners, that we're building up the interest in this, because it is something that we both really believe in, is the importance of global solidarity and really the importance of working outside of the norm. I think that's what I feel Costa Castle raised a lot, was, you know, the IWW, just to briefly give some information, they don't work the same way that the standard and mainstream labor unions work. They actually try to disregard the existing laws and try to build mobile action. But it's not, I mean, that's one example of that, and I think there are many examples of trying to do that. And I think there's importance in discussing reform. Not, I hate saying the term reform, but revolutionizing is a better term in my mind. The labor movement, the mainstream labor movements, to be more democratic, to be more driven by the members, to be more transparent, and to be also more creative in their techniques and strategies of trying to organize. And I think that is what I think our the discussion's going towards and is getting to. And I think it'd be great to kind of build onto our next show to actually discuss that.
Okay, that sounds like a plan.
Great.
What do we still need to do in this show? We had some feedback that we wanted to address, is that right?
Help will come whenever it's needed. Cheer, my comrades, cheer.
Actually, is more of a thank you.
Okay.
I will say Fab, as his name is, a co-host of Linux Outlaws, had actually given to us, he flattered us. Flatter is still working. He actually sent a message on G+ about his own traditional connections with I cannot say it in German. It's essentially solidarity in German, I think. I don't know the history of it myself, but he's very in favor of labor unions, and it was really nice to see him give me support and speaking towards the American me, that is, of how we desperately need a lot of support with our labor unions in this country, as we are able to grow, other countries are able to grow with their labor movements as well. And I hate to say that, and I don't mean to be American-centric in that sense, but we're dealing with the worst of the worst when it comes to anti-union efforts, and if we can defeat them, it's only going to make things better for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. U.S. and China, get unions fixed in U.S. and China, and we've got a chance of taking on the world, haven't we?
Yes, yeah, yeah. The All-China Federation's a whole other discussion for another day, but it's really intriguing. There is some uprisings there, too, and they do have activism. Unfortunately, it's not where Apple is, per se, and where their production lines are. Certainly a discussion for another day. I think we could kind of take a pause at this and re-approach this same topic next week and just expand more on global solidarity.
Okay, that sounds good.
Great. And with that, solidarity to all the workers out there. And we look forward to you listening to our show next week.
Mm-hmm. Goodbye. Power in the union.